Next case for argument is 14-1205, Sukumar v. Nautilus. Take your time, get ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. The District Court's summary judgment ruling for Nautilus rests not only on a misreading of the amended false marking statute in state law, but also on credibility determinations that invaded the province of the jury and adverse evidentiary inferences drawn in the movement's favor. Nautilus admits to engaging in false marking repeatedly and knowingly. The machines here were falsely marked with 16 to 24 patents. In plaintiff's evidence, corroborated by not one, but two former Nautilus employees, Frank Smith and Jeff Turner, showed that plaintiffs were deceived by this false marking, leading them to make some major outlays of cash.
So is the central issue in this case whether or not you qualify as a competitive injury under the new statute?
That's certainly part of the issue, yes, Your Honor.
So you're saying that, and that boils down to whether or not a competitive injury requires that you have been an active competitor at the time. Right?
In part, yes. Nautilus's position is that you must be a quote-unquote true competitor already on the market to establish a competitive injury under the statute.
How would you define what parameters are with respect to competitive injury?
We think the statute clearly protects both actual on-the-market competitors and potential competitors.
Can you give me a little more in terms of potential competitors? Because one could construe that broadly as being anybody who ever thought about maybe doing something in this market.
Sure.
I know you don't mean that. So what do you – I mean, the difficulty about these tests are that they create confusion and lack of predictability out there in the marketplace if we're not precise. So I want you to be as precise as you can in terms of what's required.
And here's how you should be precise. You should require an intent to compete. And you should require an ability to compete. And here you have extensive objective indicia of both. If you look, for example, at what happened over the past several years, you have money spent seeking licenses on patents. You have money spent investigating the validity of Nautilus's patents. You have money spent designing prototypes to work around patents that were falsely marked. You have money spent to buy other product lines.
Do you have a contract to sell any of the products?
A contract to sell products that the plaintiffs intended to make?
That you intended to sell.
No, they haven't reached the point of manufacturing, Your Honor. But we think to limit Section 292 to folks who are actually already competing would essentially grant immunity to the most effective false markers for keeping people completely out of the market. If you look at what the text of the statute says, it doesn't say a competitor has standing to assert an injury. It says a person has standing to assert a competitive injury. Now, why did Congress say it that way? They wanted to distinguish between people who were legitimately trying to get on the market and people who were consumers who might have had an actual injury but not a competitor.
Why wouldn't Congress said that then?
I'm sorry.
Why would Congress not have expressly said potential competitors or those who think to compete?
Your Honor, the very idea of a competitive injury, it's a concept that's common in the antitrust laws. And it's a concept, the whole idea is that you're protecting the competitive process. And so you can have actions like the actions here, repeated knowing false marking, 16 to 24 falsely marked patents on these products.
Does your record show patent by patent? So I gather that some of these patents relate to the Nautilus machines and others don't. Did your record show the particular response to each of the patents on the label?
Yes, the record
separately?
The record is quite detailed, Your Honor. So as I said, there were 16 to 24 patents on the marked machines. Eight of the patents on each of the machines didn't cover any Nautilus product whatsoever. The remainder did not cover the marked products. The Greg Webb deposition, that's a Nautilus employee who marked the machines. It's detailed concessions that this was done knowingly and repeatedly. And it shows
So was the evidence of licensing negotiations and so on directed to those patents that did cover the machines?
Your Honor, I don't know that the license, the 2009 settlement offer details each in that settlement offer letter that lists all 24 of the patents, but there's no question that there would not have been an offer to pay for a license had there not been false marking by Nautilus. There's direct causation there. I would argue even under the most stringent form of causation the district court referred to, is this the sole item that causes your injury? Why would you seek a license on a product that you know is not covered by any patent? Why would you seek to design around that product? Why would you spend money investigating the validity of those patents? There's no reason but for the false marking. So you have several categories of damages, and I encourage you to look at the categories category by category. They are classic reliance damages.
Well, that's what I'm trying to understand. So you're saying that for the patents that were on the label that clearly didn't relate to the machines that you wished to license, that there were specific expenditures and so on as to the validity of all of the patents on the label?
Yes, Your Honor, and this unfolded over time, of course. That when a potential competitor sees this many patents listed, and it has it's a matter of public record that Nautilus has aggressively enforced its intellectual property rights. It's not the kind of situation where you think, well, maybe one of these patents has expired, or maybe I can work around all 24 patents.
A reasonable person would not look and see. Well, most of the QI-TAM cases before the statute was changed was because the patents had expired. When you look at the patent numbers on the label, you don't have to know very much about patents to see that some of them had expired. Was a distinction drawn in terms of those that had expired under which one wouldn't need a license under any circumstances?
No, Your Honor. But I would note that this unfolded over time. And over time, more and more investigation was done. And there's no dispute, really, in the evidence that these expenditures were a direct response to the false marking. There's no other explanation for them. Now, to return to your question, Chief Judge.
And to the correct marking.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The expenditures you've told us were in response to the patents on the label.
The falsely marked patents. So all of them were falsely marked, Your Honor.
There were 16 to 24. Was that some related to the machines that were sold?
None. There are 16 to 24 patents marked in these machines. 8 of them didn't relate to any Nautilus product. The rest didn't relate to the products at issue. So the plaintiffs, understandably, didn't try to start copying these products right away. They invested in other ways. They had out-of-pocket expenditures, and I would emphasize we're seeking here reliance damages, not lost profits damages. But there can't be any serious question if you take the plaintiff's evidence at face value.
Can I just go back to Judge Newman's point, because I'm a little confused too. I thought that reading the judge, and I'm talking about this February 10th, 2012 order, the district court found 8 of the 24 patents marked on certain pieces of equipment did not cover the machines, and 8 of the 16 marked on others were not covering the machine. So it wasn't all the markings were not found to be improper, right?
That's not how I read that, Your Honor. This is 8 of the patents don't cover any Nautilus product, and the balance don't cover the machines at issue. So you've got several categories of damages here, and they're directly related to the issue of encountering this false marking. You've got the license, you've got the validity expenses, you've got the design around expenses. Those were the very types of expenses that this court talked about in Forest Group under the prior version of the statute. Now, obviously, Joe Q. Public can no longer bring a claim under the statute. Neither can Joe Q. Consumer. But here you have a substantial evidence of a legitimate ability to compete. You have over $1 million spent on over 200 machines. You have efforts to modify those machines. You do have contracts with equipment manufacturers to create prototypes, the Kaiser Corporation, Regeneration Equipment, and you have, of course, much of this evidence is corroborated by Frank Smith and Jeff Turner.
You kind of remind me, if I was to look at this in a sports setting, and maybe this sport doesn't exist, but you're a competitor, tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me you're a competitor that's on the sidelines saying, I want to get in the game, I want to get in the game, I want to get in the game, but you never get in the game. I mean, regardless of how much you work out and train, spend on equipment and lotions and the whole bit, you never actually got into the game.
Well, the question, Your Honor, is whether it's a reasonable inference from this evidence. So they're moving for summary judgment. All reasonable inferences have to be drawn in our favor. Is it a reasonable inference that when you spend $1 million on over 200 machines, when you spend 100...
There's no doubt about that. I mean, that's not a question how much you spend or how much was prepared to get into the game. But you never competed.
We did not actually sell products. But
so the injury you're trying to connect, it's got to be a competitive injury.
And that's why we say the statute doesn't refer, it doesn't say you have to show injury to a competitor or injury to an established competitor. It says
that you have an argument, and I'm not sure you've made it, but it seems to me that you have an argument that the reason why in this case, sitting on the sidelines when to get in is important is because we're looking at a right to exclude under a patent, meaning you're prohibited from actually entering the field of competition just out of the belief of that patents exist.
Exactly, Your Honor, and I guess that was my unstated premise, but it's like any form of unlawful monopoly conduct. An unlawful monopolist can't say, when sued for imposing antitrust injury, for example, well, they never got on the market. They didn't actually have market share. They succeeded. They kept them off the market. These patent markings had exactly the effect that they were intended to have. They kept the plaintiffs from getting to market.
And I would go there with you, except that I just don't see the evidence showing that you were going to actually fulfill the intent or the idea of entering the marketplace. You never stepped on the field at all. There's got to be more than wishful thinking.
There is far more than wishful thinking here, Your Honor. People who engage in wishful thinking don't spend money investigating the validity of the patents and spending $130,000 when plan A of copying the products fails, of trying to buy MedX machines or to buy MedX's patent portfolios. There's no risk of a cottage industry coming here of people coming in to sue to recover the money they spent on working around the patents, to get the chance of recovering what they spent out of pocket. So you have a classic situation here of a potential competitor. There's no dispute about the money spent. You have a man with a Wharton MBA and several engineering degrees. You have evidence of contracts with actual equipment manufacturers. Those all go to the ability to compete. And to say that the statute only protects those who have actually competed would really gut the statute, because it would mean that those who make startups that make major investments to compete but just don't quite get to that point can't state a claim.
Why don't we reserve the remainder of your rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Patrick Kearns. I represent Nautilus, Inc. I want to be clear about something right from the outset. I do not believe, and I disagree with my colleague, that the determination of whether a potential competitor can recover under this statute is dispositive at all. I think it's interwoven into the analysis. I think because this case began as a fault...
I'm not sure I understand your point. That it's not dispositive. In other words, you're saying that even if we were to disagree with your assumption that you have to be an active competitor at the time, you would still prevail? Is that the point you're making?
That is what I'm saying, Your Honor. The evidence in this case, and if you look at
how would you draw the line? What would you say if you're willing to say that the statute might allow someone who isn't current at the time an active competitor? What would you say that we would require the showing be?
Well, Your Honor, I happen to believe that you should have to be an active competitor to recover. And that is our position. I think there's only one way to read this statute. And Judge Reyna, as you pointed out, Congress could have said any person who suffers an injury as a result of false marking can recover. They did not. Congress used a specific term. They said competitive injury, and that means something. Plaintiffs would ask this court, as they asked the court below, to just disregard that. We're using the term potential competitor here, and I think that's interesting. The word potential competitor is a phrase developed by the plaintiffs in the lower court. But really, I think what's more apt is hypothetical competitor.
In most business settings, when you have an investor or someone looking to enter into the marketplace, and they have to show financial strength, a business plan, and they have to enter the marketplace, I can see how that would be, how one would become a competitor, go out and solicit an order. But what about in a patent case where the patentee has a right to exclude? And that means that even if you go out and solicit an order, you may be at the point of infringement. You may be at the point of having, of suffering some sort of legal injury, much less a commit. Isn't this a different situation, the patent content, when we're looking at a right to exclude and a potential investor?
Your Honor, I don't think that that's what's presented here. I think it's important to look at what the actual undisputed facts of this case were, because that's why I say that this potential competitor analysis, although important and intertwined, isn't necessarily dispositive. What the district court found here was that plaintiffs could not show any injury, no damage of any kind, competitive or otherwise. And that's significant here, because we have to look at what is actually at issue. The plaintiff has admitted, he's conceded in deposition, he manufactures nothing. He makes nothing. He sells nothing. He claims that he has these machines that he wanted to modify. He conceded that he did, in fact, modify several machines, but he's never sold one. He doesn't have a distribution facility.
Well, is that, I mean, but what is the question we're asking? I mean, you're asking us to say he's not an active, he wasn't an active competitor at the time. What if we think that that's too stringent and we think there ought to be some level of potential competitors that would be foreclosed by the marking and therefore ought to be covered and ought to be rewarded under this? If that's the circumstance, do you think this case still falls?
False in our favor. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes.
And tell me why. That, I mean, even assuming this, the sure, if the test is what you would like it to be, which is you have to be an active competitor, I don't think there's any dispute that they weren't an active competitor at the time. But what about something beyond that?
Yes, you're correct. They concede that they were not a competitor at the time. I think beyond that, let's say, for example, this court finds that there are circumstances where a potential competitor can suffer a competitive injury. That still isn't the dispositive inquiry here. The inquiry here is that Mr. Sukumar has not shown any damage as a result of these patent labels. What he has done, what the plaintiffs have done, have thrown a lot of stuff, a lot of evidence at the trial court. They said attorney's fees to attempt a license, and I want to address that. Storage fees, things of this nature which they are claiming. These have nothing to do with competition. They have nothing to do with the patent label. But he claims that they are somehow this competitive loss. The licensing fees issues.
Well, he's claiming that they incurred all of these costs in order to design around and to enter into the market when it turned out that you really didn't have a right to exclude to begin with because of your false markings. And they would not have undergone all these costs but for your false markings.
And I think that's inaccurate, Your Honor. Your hypothetical where someone was sitting on the sideline waiting to get in the game, I think it's close, but I think in truth, the plaintiffs aren't even on the sideline. They're watching from TV. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can take the plaintiffs. The plaintiffs conceded that they had no intent to enter into this market until after the lawsuit began.
Where is that in the record?
Your Honor, it's actually the court cites to it several times throughout the district court's opinion. And in the plaintiff's deposition, which is cited both, it's cited to in the district court's opinion, and it's also in the exhibits to Nautilus's motion for summary judgment. I actually took some excerpts from the deposition and put them in my brief, Your Honor. I'll paraphrase slightly, but Mr. Sukumar was asked, he said, who do you compete with? He said, Nautilus is a company that makes and sells exercise equipment. You don't make anything. You don't sell anything. Who do you compete with? Mr. Sukumar said, well, I have an intent to compete now. Later on in the record, he confirms that once the court granted partial summary judgment, an order that we didn't dispute, by the way, Your Honors, but once
you said there was no evidence of any intent to compete, and I'm not sure that's accurate. I think it may be arguable, but I don't think it's accurate to say that the record shows no evidence.
I think that here's where the two, if you want to call it evidence, here's where the two portions of evidence are. There's Mr. Sukumar's statements that he wanted to compete. Now, keep in mind, compete means something different to us, apparently, than it has to the plaintiffs. We're talking about competing in the fitness machine industry, creating and selling fitness machines. Mr. Sukumar, from the beginning, and SCSRA, have always claimed, for the decade that these lawsuits have been going on, that they intend to open spa centers, senior citizen spa centers that provide holistic and physical rehabilitation. The licensing issue, which I think is particularly notable, it's just notable, and so I'll raise it. It's just one of the several issues. You can find the letter in the record at A380 and A381. Now, this settlement letter is Mr. Sukumar's sole support for his contention that he tried to license Nautilus products. It was a letter in 2009 from his attorneys at the time of Jones Day. It was written to myself, and it right in the caption, it tells you that it was an attempt at a global settlement of three separate pending lawsuits Mr. Sukumar had, none of them about false marking, none of them about patents, none of them about the stickers on the machines. And it says, right to you, it says, Mr. Sukumar, among the many things that he would like as part of this settlement, a license under Nautilus patents and applications to make and have made for use exclusively in Sukumar-owned rehabilitation centers. Not to sell these machines, not to engage in competition with Nautilus, to buy the machines, to be a customer, and to modify them, and to use them in his centers. Moreover, even if you consider that a true attempt to license the patent, which, by the way, I suggest that it's not. It was part of a settlement offer that contained a monetary component that they hadn't said yet, so it was a partial offer. Well, why the offer and why the monetary component? It says any settlement should include some monetary component designed to compensate our clients for their losses relating to the defendant's failure to perform on the contracts at issue. That is another glaring thing here that the plaintiffs don't want to talk about, and they didn't mention in their brief, and it should be mentioned. Mr. Sukumar has routinely changed the reason why he's damaged from lawsuit to lawsuit to lawsuit. The district court recognized this. The district court, one of the most glaring examples are these storage fees damages. SCSRA and Mr. Sukumar are claiming that they've incurred hundreds of thousands of dollars in storage fees as a result of the false marking. This is what they told the court here. Yet in another pending case in the Southern District of California, after this case was already filed, Mr. Sukumar filed a brief with that court and said those same storage fees were the result of a breach of warranty involving the paint on the machines. The same storage fees were in a state court trial. They were at issue in a state court trial against Nautilus and one of its distributors for breach of contract and interference with contract. These damages did not result from false marking labels. These damages have been, by Sukumar's own testimony, by his own sworn statements, the cause of everything else until we got to the false marking.
How should we treat the evidence in the record that Nautilus has some sort of history of falsely marking its products?
Well, Your Honor, I think it has very limited value in this case, and I'll tell you why. First of all, on this appeal, the plaintiffs didn't – there was a motion for partial summary judgment that they brought seeking various elements, and Nautilus didn't dispute the fact that certain – numbers on these labels were not accurate. Now, I disagree with counsel that they didn't apply at all. They were all Nautilus's patents. What Nautilus had done was created what we called a unilabel. It was one sticker that listed a number of patents, and this label was, for whatever reason, put on several different machines. So not necessarily every patent number on every sticker applied to that given machine, and we acknowledge that. But that really, beyond that, beyond acknowledging that those labels are, in that sense, incorrect, And if you set aside for the moment the expired patents that were on some of those things, the net issue hasn't been litigated in this case at all. I think it has zero impact on the outcome of this case and really zero impact on the analysis. I think the focus here needs to be what, if anything, has Mr. Sukumar shown below to identify that these patent labels actually caused him some kind of injury. And it's important to look not only at the storage fees issue and not only at these licensing issue, but it's important to look at the evidence that was actually produced by their side. Their argument in their brief and their argument here today before this court sort of presumes that they've suffered these damages.
Isn't the restrictive nature of the right to exclude, shouldn't there be some sort of burden on let's say, Nautilus in this case, once it's shown that there's false marking in order to show that the injury should not be attributed to you?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, this is a statutory cause of action where they have to prove at a minimum.
What I see here is that Nautilus had, on a prior occasion, engaged in false marketing of its products. Now we come to this situation, and again, you're arguing don't hold us liable because they were all Nautilus patents. Some may have been expired. Some may have applied to other machines, but the fact is that this label was on particular machines that it didn't apply to, and those machines were not patented under those markings. And it seems to me that given the restrictive nature of the right to exclude, that if under the statute we allow businesses to utilize patent markings time and time again and not face any type of repercussion, then what's the use of the statute?
I don't think it's allowing businesses to not face any repercussion. I think that just like any other statute or just like any other cause of action, the plaintiffs need to simply prove their case. They need to prove that false marking has actually occurred. Now, they have not done so in this case. Let's be clear. Nautilus did concede that some of these labels did not apply to the machines, but we never got to the next step, which is, as this court has recognized, a very important step, the intent to deceive. We've never gotten that far in litigation. So Nautilus hasn't conceded that it's violated the law by any means. I think the plaintiffs need to only prove their case, Your Honor. And Congress has provided a remedy for exactly that type of conduct. But we don't.
In your view, that proving the case includes not just showing that there was a false marking, but as the statute says, that they filed that they have suffered competitive injury as a result of that marking, that that's their burden and not yours to show the injury?
I believe so, Your Honor. But I also think, to a sense, that we haven't got that either. In other words, this court doesn't have to find that in order to affirm this ruling.
You're not arguing that intent to deceive is a necessary finding under 292, right?
Well, that's not an issue here, Your Honor.
But you said it was. You said that was the next step. It's okay. You can go
it's on. Okay, Your Honor. I just want to craft it in the sense that we are at a procedural position here where we basically, in effect, said, show us all your evidence that you've been damaged at all. The competitive injury or the potential competitor or hypothetical competitor, however you want to say that, really what it is, it's a causation requirement. The federal statute has it. All the state law claims have it. They all require some sort of proof, at least at some point in time, by the plaintiff bringing the cause of action, that it was, in fact, these labels that damaged it. Because what if we don't have that? What if we don't require that burden of the people bringing the claim? Then we're just back to a QI-TAM statute. Then we've rendered the changes to the AIA meaningless.
But I think the issue here is whether a potential competitor qualifies under the statute. And then, for example, if we were to find that the answer to that is yes, then we would send it back down to consider the damages and the applicability of any damages.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because if you look at the district court's opinion, the district court acknowledged that it did not decide that a potential competitor could never sue or never recover under the statute, and it didn't have to. In fact, the court said, quote, it may be perhaps an interesting legal issue. And it is. And I think in some sense it gives a lot of context to this case. But regardless of whether they are able to get their foot in the Section 292 door, they still have no damages that they can prove resulted from the patent labels.
And you think even under the summary judgment standard, with all inferences going their way, there's still not absolutely not enough evidence?
I absolutely think so, Your Honor. I think it's a difficult case in the sense that there's a lot. I mean, you know, there was a classic story. A judge once said to me that, you know, you get a summary judgment motion so high and you know that there's got to be a disputed fact in there somewhere. I think that this is that sort of case where you're claiming attorney's fees. You're claiming storage costs. You're claiming I couldn't enter into that market. But then you just got to look at Mr. Sukumar's sworn testimony.
Isn't it a factual issue to determine whether those are related to the false markings?
Not when the plaintiff has conceded that they're not. Not when the plaintiff says, for example, I didn't have any intent to compete with their until after the lawsuit. You know, another thing the plaintiff conceded, that he bought 50 more Nautilus machines after the lawsuit started. I mean, that was significant. My colleague here said Mr. Sukumar's bought 200 machines, but you know, 100 of those were in 1998 and 50 of them were during this lawsuit. I mean, these are all these things to consider, but at the end, I think the district court got this absolutely right. Thank you very much, Your Honors. I understand my time.
A few points, Your Honor. Just to keep the time even.
Thank you. How much do I have, Your Honor?
We'll give you 3 minutes.
Thank you. A few quick points. Let me begin with intent to compete. It is absolutely incorrect that the plaintiff here said he didn't intend to manufacture before this lawsuit. If you look at pages A323, A324 of the joint appendix, Mr. Sukumar was asked at his deposition the question, when did your intent change to making machines for resale? Response, basically, I reject the premise of your question. Quote, making machines for resale was also part of that prior intent. Previous page 323. It was, quote, also my intent to use the knowledge gained in modifying the machine to make machines of my own, distinctive machines suiting my particular market segment. You don't have to rely on just this, though. You can look at the testimony of Frank Smith, page A481 to 482.
Well,
Jeff
I thought
Turner.
The point in this regard wasn't that he never said it, but that it was he said something contradictory in other circumstances.
No, there is no contradiction, Your Honor. The declaration says it was always his intent. The district court said, oh, but in his deposition, he conceded it wasn't always his intent. As explained on page 39 of our brief and the quote that I just read you, he never said it wasn't always his intent. He said it's been part of my intent from the beginning. Now, if there were a conflict, you have the corroborating testimony of Frank Smith, which you find at 481 to 482. You have the corroborating testimony of Jeff Turner at 496. And under Federal Rule of Evidence 801 D2, those statements could be used to rehabilitate his testimony. It's not necessary because there is no conflict. Of course, finally, you have the fact that actions speak louder than words, and he did all these things to move toward the market. That speaks to his intent as well. As to the 2009 license that Mr. Kearns referred to, there's nothing inconsistent with the desire for a license limited to rehabilitation centers, which was part of Mr. Sukumar's business plan, and the settlement offer and the intent to have a broader desire to manufacture. If you look at the record again, page A369, Mr. Sukumar says, we didn't seek a general license in those settlement negotiations because we didn't believe it was realistic. On the issue of causation, I encourage you to look at these category by category. Mr. Kearns has spoken about storage costs and about representations in prior cases. There's been no allegation of double recovery, no suggestion of getting two bites at the apple. We have disclaimed any storage costs damages that are not directly related to purchases of machines caused by the false marking. But then there are these other categories of damages. The money spent on seeking licenses, the money spent on design arounds. If you look at the Forest Group case, it asked the question, did the false marking, quote, cause unnecessary investment in design around or costs incurred to analyze the validity or enforceability of a patent? It's page 1303 of the opinion. That's exactly what you have here. The fact that some of these fees are costs and damages are attorney's fees, well, that's how one looks at the validity of a patent. You hire an attorney to investigate it. These are classic reliance damages. There's no question that they trace to the false marking at issue in this case, and there's no question that if you draw reasonable inferences in favor of plaintiff's evidence, that this case should proceed to trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.